Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 21, 2016, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group courthouse steps telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's opinion yesterday in Quozo Speed Technologies v. Lee. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome return Teleforum guest, Professor Kristen Osinga. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here, and we'll move right into her presentation of about 20 minutes, followed by your questions. With that, Professor Osinga, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Will. As Will noted, I am Kristen Osinga, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law. I'll be talking to you today about the Supreme Court's decision in Quozo Speed Technologies v. Lee, issued yesterday, June 20th. The case was argued in April of this year. I don't normally do this, but I am going to give a little bit of a technical patent law background. While many of you listening are well-versed in patent law, I want to make sure that everyone on the call will understand the important points of this case. I'll try to be very brief in this section for everyone's sake. Patents are issued by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, PTO, or Patent Office for short, after an initial examination process. For a number of years now, there has been administrative procedures available that allow the Patent Office to re-examine issued patents that maybe shouldn't have been granted in the first place. The purpose of these procedures is to provide an alternative to litigation as the only means to have an issued patent rendered invalid. As part of the America Invents Act, a process known as inter-parties review was created that allows a third party to ask the Patent Office to re-examine an issued patent and cancel any patent claim that is not novel or is obvious over the prior art. The requester, the party seeking the inter-parties review, has to plead with particularity why the patent subject to the request is invalid over the prior art. The Patent Office then determines whether to institute the requested inter-parties review based on the standard of whether or not the requester has shown, quote, a reasonable likelihood that they would prevail. The decision to institute a review is made by the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. The board conducts this proceeding, reaches a conclusion, and issues an opinion providing its reasoning for the inter-parties review decision. Along with the creation of inter-parties review and the Patent Trial and Appeal Board itself, a number of statutory provisions were added to the Patent Act with the American Invents Act. Two of these statutory provisions are at issue in the Quozo case. The first provision is 35 U.S.C. Section 314D that says, the determination of the Patent Office whether to institute an inter-parties review under this section shall be final and non-appealable. The first issue in the Quozo case, then, is does that really mean it's not appealable? The second provision is 35 U.S.C. Section 316A4, which gives the Patent Office the authority to issue regulations establishing and governing inter-parties review under this chapter. At the heart of the second issue is a regulation that was issued by the Patent Office that states, during inter-parties review, the Patent Office shall construe a patent claim according to its broadest reasonable construction. Now, this is a different standard than that used by district courts when assessing a patent's validity during litigation. In a district court, the standard is that patent terms should be given their ordinary meaning as given to them by a person having skill in the art. Clearly, broadest reasonable construction is somewhat different. The question in the Quozo case, then, was whether the Patent Office can use the broadest reasonable construction standard to construe patent claim terms during inter-parties review. That should give enough of the background. Now I'd like to tell you a few minutes about the factual and procedural background of the particular case that was heard by the Supreme Court. Quozo Speed Technologies owned the rights to United States Patent Number 6778074, or we'll just call it the Quozo patent or the 074 patent, which was issued in 2004. In 2012, Garmin International and Garmin USA, which I'll refer to as Garmin, filed a petition with the Patent Office seeking inter-parties review of the 074 patent. As is required to request an inter-parties review, Garmin particularly pointed to Claim 17 and explained why they believed that claim was obvious in light of three other United States patents. The board then agreed to re-examine Claim 17 as part of inter-parties review, but also Claims 10 and 14, even though Garmin had not expressly challenged these other two claims. The board said that Garmin had implicitly challenged Claims 10 and 14 because Claim 17 depended on Claim 14, which in turn depended on Claim 10. Or for those of you without a patent background, you can think about it this way. Claim 17 cross-references and includes everything stated in Claim 14, which cross-references includes everything in Claim 10. For that reason, for this interrelationship between the claims, the board decided to review all three claims together. After the inter-parties review proceedings, the board concluded all three claims, 10, 14, and 17, were obvious in light of the prior art that Garmin had put forward in its petition, and ultimately ordered all these claims to be canceled. Quozo appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, making 2 points on appeal. First, Quozo argued that the Patent Office's institution of the inter-parties review, at least with respect to claims 10 and 14, was improper. Second, Quozo argued that the Patent Office's claim construction standard for inter-parties review, the broadest reasonable construction standard, was improper. At the Federal Circuit, a divided panel rejected both of Quozo's arguments, stating that 35 U.S.C. 314D clearly stated that the decision to institute inter-parties review is non-appealable, and that the Patent Office's decision to use the broadest reasonable construction standard was within its authority that had been granted by Congress. On both of these issues, the Supreme Court granted certiorari, and that led to the case that we're talking about today. Now, usually when the Supreme Court takes a patent case nowadays, it's to tell the Federal Circuit they're doing something wrong. For just one example, as Will alluded to in the introduction, in the HALO case that I talked about last week, it was the Supreme Court stepping in to tell the Federal Circuit they were wrong. However, I'm going to spoil the mystery now and tell you that the Supreme Court, in this case, agreed with the Federal Circuit on both issues, on both the issue of whether or not decisions to institute inter-parties review is appealable, and the use of the broadest reasonable construction standard. Now, to agree with the Federal Circuit, the Supreme Court goes through a lengthy discourse, both on statutory interpretation and administrative law, in an opinion that was written by Justice Breyer. On the issue of whether Quozo can seek review of the Patent Office's decision to institute the inter-parties review of these three claims, the Supreme Court starts off with what seems like the simplest, and in my opinion, the best reason. To paraphrase the court, it's not appealable, for one thing, because that's what the statute says. 314D says non-appealable. The court then goes on to provide some additional bases for this decision. For example, contrary to Quozo's contention that Claim 10 and 14 should not have been included because Garmin only pled particularly with respect to Claim 17, the court notes these three claims are logically linked, as I explained earlier, and there is no reason for Garmin to have to repeat the same argument three times. Additionally, the court highlights the policy behind inter-parties review, noting that to allow the Patent Office's final decision to be, quote, unwound under some minor statutory technicality, end quote, would undermine the purpose of the proceeding itself. The idea is to have a means to invalidate patents that possibly shouldn't have been issued in the first place. Finally, the court looks at how similar provisions regarding non-appealability are treated in other areas of law, especially where the clear language of the statute and the intent of the statutory scheme can be inferred to support the idea of non-review. Now, importantly, the court does take one small step back, noting that the opinion does not decide the effect of Section 314D on appeals that would do things like implicate constitutional issues, or if what's being appealed reaches well beyond the scope of the inter-parties review section of the code. So they're not shutting off appeals entirely, but they are with simple, as they called them, minor statutory technicalities. So moving on now to the second issue. On the issue of whether the Patent Office can use the broadest reasonable construction standard when conducting an inter-parties review, the Supreme Court again agreed with the Federal Circuit, stating that the Patent Office did have the authority to issue the regulation that calls for the broadest reasonable construction. Naturally, the Supreme Court starts by pointing to Chevron, noting that where there is a statute, an agency must follow it, but where there is a gap, an agency may enact reasonable rules to fill that gap. Here, the Supreme Court said, not only is there a gap, Congress did not tell the Patent Office what standard to use for claim construction, but there is also an explicit grant of authority, expressly authorizing the Patent Office to issue rules to govern inter-parties review proceedings. The court then goes on to address Quozo's argument that the broadest reasonable construction standard must have been intended given its trial-like nature of inter-parties review. At trial, they use ordinary and customary meaning. So because the inter-parties review is like a mini-trial, then it should, too, be the ordinary and customary meaning. The court addresses that and says, no, that's not right. Inter-parties review is not actually like a trial. It has some trial-like aspects, but it is an agency proceeding. The court points to other differences between inter-parties review and invalidation of patents of the district court, including things like burden of the burden of proof, as well as the purpose between each. As stated by the court, the purpose of inter-parties review is to afford the patent office another opportunity to examine its own work, to look at patents that may or may not have been, should have been issued in the first place, which is different, according to the court, than a district court looking at patents that the patent office shouldn't have granted. So it's a re-looking at my own work is somehow different than a court looking at the patent office's work, and because of that, the court draws a line. Now, because there's a difference, because there's a gap, and because there's this delegation of authority, what the Supreme Court does next is determine whether or not what the agency has done to fill the gap is reasonable. So here the Supreme Court looked at the broadest reasonable construction standard, the regulation that sets it out, and finds it to be reasonable. Now, in determining whether or not the broadest reasonable construction is reasonable, the Supreme Court points to public policy, that is, saying that using the broadest reasonable construction standard protects the public by encouraging patent applicants to draft narrow claims, allows for invalidation of very broad patents, etc., all in the public's best interest, according to the court. Additionally, the court points to past practice to support the regulation, specifically noting that the Patent Office has been using the broadest reasonable construction standard in various proceedings for well over 100 years. So, Cuozzo has made two other arguments that the court dispensed with towards the end of their opinion, its opinion. First, Cuozzo argued that there should be a difference between when the Patent Office initially examines a patent application before it's ever granted in the first instance and when it reviews an already issued patent. And part of the argument that Cuozzo makes there is that during initial examination, the applicant has a right to amend claims to address prior art concerns that are raised during examination, while during inter-parties review, there's no absolute right. In fact, Cuozzo cited numbers that requests to amend during inter-parties review proceedings are rarely granted. I believe the numbers I was looking at this morning are something like 5 or 6 out of 118 times have they granted this request to amend. The court, however, was very unswayed by this argument. They say that the patentee has ample opportunity to amend during initial examination, which isn't entirely accurate, but has a point. And the Supreme Court said that the fact that requests to amend during inter-parties review are rarely granted may simply be a reflection that the amendments that were requested during inter-parties review wouldn't have saved the invention, that the patent simply shouldn't have been granted in the first place. The second argument that Cuozzo made that the Supreme Court addresses is the idea that using different claim construction standards in inter-parties review than the standards used during litigation will produce inconsistent results and added confusion to the patent system. The court answers simply that inter-parties review is a different procedure. The patent system provides different tracks for looking at patent claims. There's district court, there's the patent office. These are different tracks. These different tracks have different burdens of proof, different procedures, different avenues available, and the presence of a different claim construction between these different tracks was just part of Congress's design choice when setting up the tracks to review patent validity. Further, the Supreme Court says, the Patent Office uses the standard, the broadest reasonable construction standard, in other areas that also have district court implications, one of them mentioned being interferences. And so trying to create uniformity of standards for uniformity's sake would be difficult and not preferred. Finally, the court wraps up the majority opinion by noting that although Cuozzo and a number of amici offered policy reasons for why the ordinary and customary meaning standard should be used rather than the broadest reasonable construction standard, the court said it was not going to second-guess the Patent Office after finding that the broadest reasonable construction standard was reasonable. So, in addition to the opinion of the court, delivered, as I said earlier, by Justice Breyer, There were two additional opinions filed in this case. Justice Thomas wrote a concurring opinion, and Justice Alito, joined by Justice Sotomayor, wrote an opinion concurring in part, but dissenting with respect to the majority's opinion on the appealability of decisions to institute inter-parties review. I'll take a few minutes now to highlight those two opinions. Justice Thomas wrote a very brief concurrence to suggest that the court should reconsider what he calls the fiction of Chevron, that an ambiguity is an implicit delegation of power for an agency to act. However, in this case, he notes that there's not simply an ambiguity, but rather an express delegation of authority to the Patent Office to promulgate rules governing inter-parties review proceedings. Thus, he joined the court's opinion in full. Justice Alito, joined by Justice Sotomayor, wrote to dissent from the court's holding and reasoning on the issue of appealability. He did join the majority on the issue of broadest reasonable construction standard. Justice Alito's argument is premised on the strong presumption in favor of judicial review of administrative actions. Although the presumption can be rebutted, he states that if a provision can be reasonably read to permit judicial review, it should be read that way. The reasonable interpretation that Justice Alito argues for is that Section 314D means that only an appeal from the institution decision itself is not permitted, but at the end of the proceeding, institution-related issues can be reviewed in full. Basically, he's contending that the statute should be read to forbid appeals at the point of institution of an inter-parties review step, no interlocutory appeals. A court cannot stop the proceeding from going forward. However, he says it can be reviewed as a whole at the time the inter-parties review proceeding concludes. He goes on to address the majority's arguments about purpose and policy. In the interest of time, I will leave these to you to read if you are interested. So, bottom line, what does this all mean? And again, please note, my remarks represent my comments alone and are not the position of the Federalist Society, the University of Richmond, or any other organization. On the issue of unappealability or non-appealability, it seems pretty straightforward. Congress wrote it in 314D and wrote it in pretty plainly. The court acknowledges that some issues must always be reviewable, such as constitutional questions and the like, and they did not give us a full listing of inter-parties review decisions that can be reviewed or not reviewed. On the other hand, the Patent Office sometimes does crazy things, and to have no review may allow some of that crazy to go forward unfettered. However, I believe that if the Patent Office goes too far off base, this is likely to be precisely the quote-unquote shenanigans that the court signaled where review would be allowed. Now, looking over some of the comments from industry that have come out since the opinion came down yesterday, there's a concern that, of course, this could lead to a spate of shenanigans cases as attorneys try to find out where those boundaries are between what is reviewable and what isn't. However, I think with the specific statement of constitutional questions and the like, that the bar has been set pretty fairly high. On the issue of broadest reasonable construction, well, it's what we've had forever, or at least for a very long time, and so there's no change. And as an administrative law inquiry, the court is probably right that it's reasonable, and it's probably within the grant of delegation. But that doesn't mean that the standard itself is the best, and it probably isn't. The broadest reasonable construction standard probably causes more policy problems than it solves, and it probably should be fixed. There are some significant concerns about the number of patents being killed via these post-issuance review proceedings, as well as how few requests are granted to amend patents during these proceedings. But Congress didn't fix this with the American Invents Act, and the court shouldn't probably fix it now, so the case is what it is. No doubt, patent owners have already and are likely to go again to Congress to ask for this change. In an election year, it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. As a practical matter, in the meantime, it probably means that the claim should be drafted more narrowly and more clearly going forward, and that isn't an entirely bad thing. For the most part, this opinion retains the status quo, surprising when the Supreme Court takes a Federal Circuit opinion. The only real interesting angle, aside from how attorneys may be able to get review of inter-parties review decisions, may actually be something bigger, the opening of a door to other challenges to Patent Office rulemaking, which previously had been limited by the Federal Circuit. I think it'll be interesting to see where this path leads next. That concludes my remarks. I will turn it back to Will.
All right, thank you, Professor. We'll open the floor now to audience questions. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, again, if you have a question, please hit star and the pound key. Our lines are wide open right now. I'll take the chance to ask the first question here. Professor, in your amicus brief with Greg Dolan, Adam Mossoff, and some others, there are some interesting takings arguments made about the current patent review board regime. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. There's a vast concern about how many patents are being invalidated by the board. One of the arguments for why these are being invalidated at such a high rate is the broadest reasonable construction standard. And because patents as issued are property rights, the vast killing off of these patents is arguably a taking. Now, it's a fine argument. Obviously, I thought so when I signed on to the amicus brief. But as usual, the takings arguments in patent cases don't tend to go very far. It's unfortunate. I think it's a valid argument, but I don't know that the Supreme Court is really going to bite into that as a solid argument going forward. However, I think it is important to get that in front of them and as a point that they should consider while they're considering the rest of the amicus briefs.
All right, we're still waiting to see if an audience member might have a question here. If you hit star and then the pound key, we'll put you on right away. You'll be our very first question of the day. While we wait to see if anybody has a question, I want to make a quick commercial announcement. Our next Teleform call is scheduled for tomorrow at noon. It is titled Devolution and Secession in the Modern World. We'll be discussing the Brexit vote that will be taking place in England on Thursday. So we hope to hear from a lot of you tomorrow afternoon at noon for that call. I don't see any audience questions here, so if you have a final thought that you'd like to make before we adjourn, I'd welcome that now.
No real final thoughts. I appreciate everybody listening in.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for dialing in. This is a very thorough presentation, and I'm sure everyone is perfectly clear now, and that's why there are no questions. We'll have this recording up very soon if you want to review Professor Osingo's remarks. We hope to hear from you tomorrow afternoon, but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.